This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
A few days ago, I called the fake news the enemy of the people, and they are.
We could make deals in Russia very easily if we wanted to. I just don't want to because I think that would be a conflict. I have a no conflict of interest provision as president, and that's something that Nazi Germany would have done and did do. I think it's a disgrace.
Hello and welcome to Trumpcast, the show about the man who thinks exercise uses too much of the body's finite energy, Donald Trump. I'm Jacob Weisberg, and we're back for the second edition of the Trumpcast Book Club. I want to welcome back Katie Roifey of NYU and Philip Gurevich of The New Yorker. Thanks for coming back for another round, guys.
Good to be here.
I imagine that at some point in the last several weeks, you were cursing me. Both of you were cursing me reading this book. That's uncomfortable. Kind of. That was the uncomfortable laugh of truth. But I want to explain why I picked it, because I was trying to remember, but it had to do with our last book. Philip Roth wrote an email to The New Yorker apropos of our first book, The Plot Against America, and he was talking about it. And I'm just going to read this thing from his email that he sent to The New Yorker. He said, it's easier to comprehend the election of an imaginary president like Charles Lindbergh than an actual president like Donald Trump. And he said that Lindbergh, despite his Nazi sympathies, was a great aviation hero who had physical courage and obviously crossed the Atlantic solo in 1927. But he goes on to say, Trump is just a con artist. And Philip Roth said the relevant book about Trump's American forebearer is Herman Melville's The Confidence Man, which he describes as the darkly pessimistic, daringly inventive novel, which was Melville's last, that could just as well have been called The Art of the Scam. So I read that and I thought, this is the book that's going to explain Donald Trump to me. And it explained Donald Trump, right? We understand him now.
All right, I'm going to be the weird defender on him. I mean, even if you pass the buck to Philip Roth for assigning this book.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a completely mad book and impenetrable in many ways. And it sort of takes everything that's maddeningly hard to read about Shakespeare and then sort of puts it to some exponential level of extra density and without a coherent plot or situation. And yet, there are a lot of things in here that actually are pretty usable for thinking about the present.
Before we dig into it, what was your just reaction to it? Did you enjoy reading this book in any way?
No.
Yeah.
I can't even say I enjoyed reading it anyway, but I did find it a little bit interesting, in part because I'm very interested in con men in general. So I found it weirdly fascinating. And I just want to bring up that I think it was Bloomberg who first called Trump a con man. He said, I'm from New York and I recognize a con man when I see him.
At the convention.
Yes.
Yeah,
like, he was the one who first brought up that idea publicly of like, maybe Trump's a con man. And obviously this con man is quite different from Trump because he's, for one thing, like silver-tongued. He's like a beautiful rhetorician in a way. So it's in a way like a different genre of con man. But I think we could also talk a lot about the people that are conned and the psychology of being conned, which I think kind of explains. I was really upset to read the New York Times article today about Trump voters kind of revisiting people who voted for Trump and were they happy or unhappy with the first 100 days. And it was kind of like they're happy because they love him and nothing that's happened or not happened in the first 100 days like really matter at all. And that felt weirdly relevant to me to this book.
Well, first, before we get into it and before we get into the Trump part of it, I think we should just talk about what the book is a little bit. Philip, can you just kind of describe you can't say the plot because there isn't that much of one. There's a little bit of one. But to, just to say what happens in this book.
Well, the book is set on April Fool's Day, and it was published actually on April 1st, 1857. And it starts with a mysterious stranger, a stranger in the most extreme sense of the word or something, he says, arriving at St. Louis on the dock and stepping aboard a steamship bound for New Orleans on the Mississippi River called, ironically enough, the Fidel, as in the faithful.
Yeah.
And it just it almost starts like a play. You've got this kind of cast of the various passengers who kind of exit and enter onto the boat as it sort of it seems to be a local, essentially, that sort of stops here and there on either shore, dropping off and picking up people. And, you know, the context is this is the mid-1850s. It's a decade before the Civil War. It's a time of tremendous expansion. It's a time of Wall Street boom and bust. There are all kinds of scam artists and everything else. And it's from the very beginning, this kind of high-blown, high-rhetoric Melville kind of philosophical dialogues that are staged in one encounter after another between this con man in various guises and various marks who are the passengers about the nature of trust, the nature of confidence, the nature of charity, and at some very core level, is humankind more good than wicked? I mean, are we to be trusted or are we fundamentally untrustworthy? And that question of like actual nature versus our higher ideals keeps popping up. And he is constantly persuading people, you must trust me. He's constantly preaching various gospels of charity and confidence and trust and what, you know, will you be my friend? I am so bereft. Oh, I am alone in the world and you I see a sympathetic man. You, my dear lady, are one of the few people I think I can confide in. Will you show your confidence in me? And well, what would that mean? You know, basically it usually means at some point he's going to put the touch on them. It could be for a coin. It could be for a great deal more. He builds some elaborate schemes where he's selling stock in the Black Diamond, what is it called? The Black River Coal Company. He has a Seminole widow and orphan asylum. He's selling plots of land in a utopian community called New Jerusalem, founded by fugitive Mormons. He's hawking herbal cures. And these are all in different guises.
They're different characters, right? I mean, the first one is a crippled black man who's laying on the deck of the ship,
right?
And people are doubting whether he's genuinely crippled
or black.
Yes.
So the whole thing, and then he hawks herbal cures, Omni Balsamic Reinvigorator. I mean, these things are kind of wild. And he also has this crazy idea that he's pitching of a world charity that'll put in, you know, if everybody gives a little bit to this charity, there'll be enough money to end the need for charity forever. But each of these different characters also then, in its next guise, perpetuates certain cons so that you have this self-reinforcing system. If I went to you, Katie, and said, you want to buy, you know, I've heard about this fantastic opportunity in the Black River Coal Company, then a little while later, I would, in a different guise, show up and talk to you about it, Jacob. And then the two of you would talk to each other that you'd heard about this. And the next time I'd be in a third guise and both of you would be ready to buy.
Right. And his last scam, which is incredibly elaborate and he spends a lot of time on, is to steal a free 10-cent haircut.
Right.
So the value of what he's conning is wildly varying. And the cripple at the beginning is just trying to get some coins, right?
There's a great line about that early on where somebody's basically saying, oh, all you people who talk about trust and charity and confidence, you're always on the make. You're always in it for a buck. And he says, oh, what did the snake get from conning Eve, basically?
Yeah.
Nothing. And there's actually a pure motive of kind of wickedness or of showing the wicked nature of humankind prevails.
So, Katie, an idea that immediately comes up is that this character who can inhabit these different identities is the devil. Did you read this to be a book about the devil?
Well, it definitely raises the religious overtones, but I think it's playing with that, but he's more than that because he's also, you know, in a way, he just has the joy of persuasion. If he is the devil, he's more like Milton Satan. He's like a devil that enjoys language. Because to me, he's more like the writer or, you know, somebody who's playing with words, which is a very specific idea of the devil that is not necessarily, you know, strictly Christian.
And he has a lot of ideas about literature, right? I mean, there's a lot of discussion of Shakespeare, and
Tacitus.
And he comes across a guy reading Tacitus and wants to throw his book in the river because Tacitus will poison his mind. Why? What's the problem with Tacitus? He's too negative.
I'm
not a Tacitus scholar, but you know, the idea is, yes, that basically that Tacitus is a cynic.
And in
some way, it's basically he has a cynical view of humankind. And this guy, in his way of preaching hope, is to say that poisons the mind of all you young students. And this is the book you mustn't read. You must read books that are happy and cheerful and show good things. I mean, there's a lot of riffing on literature in general. There are two great chapters on what the problem is for the novelist in presenting believable characters. And one of them is all about inconsistency versus consistency, and that most readers will say, well, this character's not realistic. They're totally inconsistent. And he's saying, but in fact, that's how people are. And that fiction, the biggest fiction in fiction, is to make characters credible as opposed to the way they appear in nature.
So he might be the devil in some sense. Is he a particularly American character? I mean, is the con man an American phenomenon?
I mean, apparently there were a lot of con men operating at that time. It was a time of great scams.
It was a thing in the
self-invention, the American dream.
Yeah.
There was a famous case in 1855, which when he started this thing, there was in all the New York papers about a guy who literally went around talking like this guy, saying, you know, oh, you must have confidence, accosting strangers. Do you trust me? Would you trust me? What do you believe in confidence? And then, like, may I borrow your watch?
Mm. His name was Ronald Drumpf. Yes.
Well, I mean, it's kind of like this guy who went around the country for the last year and a half. May I borrow your White House?
Yeah. But that was this guy's scam. May I borrow your watch? And then you'd never see him again.
Then he got caught. Yeah. And even then, the local papers apparently were thundering about him and saying, why is this the big case when you could get the bigger fish on Wall Street?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, in other words, there was this idea that there's a continuum from this petty crime to the top, that it was a kind of American character, the selling of bogus real estate. The idea that there was also belief and hope, right? That you could sell belief and hope in extremely flimsy properties of one kind or another. And people sort of thought, yes, I've heard stories just like that, where somebody entrusted a stranger with $10 and now is a millionaire, you know? And so there was this playing off that, playing off what is incredible by simply saying, don't you want it to become true? What isn't reality essentially what we're going to invent it as?
Yeah.
Yeah, and there definitely is an incredible, like the scheme that you were talking about earlier, Philip, where there's going to be this charity that's going to, you're going to give all this money to this one charity, which will end all, like, human suffering. And there is something, both the sort of, like, ragtag, like, selling cures kind of, you know, you see them in The Wizard of Oz, even, like, this old-fashioned American idea, but also the inventing this, creating this new world that's going to solve all the problems of the old world. It is American. And one thing I was struck by is that he plays very fast and loose with the truth and with other people, even with other people's memories. Like, one time he meets somebody and he's like, don't you remember we've met before? You know, you do remember this party? He's like, you took me home.
At your house for dinner.
Yes,
right.
I was at your house for dinner. And the guy's like, no, I don't remember you at all. And he's like, did you have a fall? Maybe you forgot because you bumped your head. And the guy's like, well, I did have a fall. And suddenly he's doubting his own memory that he hadn't had dinner with this guy. So he's literally, his approach to the truth, again, it's like Trump's alternative facts, is so, we could say, creative, you know, to be that brazen to, like, reinvent someone's memory and be like, of course you know me. That idea it's like the purest form of self-invention.
I mean, the cons seem pretty familiar, a lot of them, right? They're still, the versions of this are still circulating on the internet.
Oh, totally. A lot of them are like the ones you get that say, you know, if you could just lend me your bank account for a minute, the son of, you know, Mobutu will put my diamond mine in your account and you will keep 20%, or the ones we get from somebody who's hacked, you know.
Yeah. My wallet has been stolen.
Right.
Yeah.
My passport and wallet.
Will you kindly give me
wire to Madrid immediately?
That is one of his scams. He's lost. He has money. He just doesn't have it on him. So
that's
you
right.
Lend him $10 or $20 or whatever he wants. But he kind of argues people to death. I mean, the scene with the barber at the end is like unbelievable, because the barber has a sign up that says no trust, which means you're not going to get a shave on credit. And the confidence man spends pages and pages trying to tell him how terrible it is not to trust people, and says he will indemnify him. He will make him a guarantee that if he will only take this sign down and trust his customers, he will make up for any loss. And the barber is finally beaten down, says, okay. And then the confidence man says, of course, and thank you. And now please give me a haircut. And the barber says, well, pay me first. And he said, what do you mean? I'm just agreed to cover all your losses. But of course, no money down.
Right. So the first thing he does after convincing the guy finally that he should trust people more is scam him.
Is scam him.
And make him totally betray it.
But he's exhausting, the confidence man. I mean, you yield to him. You might yield to him because you're fooled by him, but you might also just surrender to his willingness to argue his position forever.
But this is where I think that, like, this is where I saw the kind of not one-to-one analogy, but the sort of way that this book can kind of inform a bit our understanding of just now, which is he is selling hope and trust. And in a way, the last president did a lot of that. And
believe me.
I mean, that's also hope. Trump's,
yeah.
No, I'm saying the last president.
Oh, the last president,
that.
Sorry.
And Trump comes along and he's basically got a dark view. He's like, ah, yeah, you know, all those guys, they make a shiny world look for you. But, you know, it's a terrible, terrible time. It's American carnage. It's darkness. It's everything is being shuttered. The immigrants are coming across the border. We have to protect ourselves and turn inward. And you have the other view, which is the sort of sunny view. And they are two views of human nature that they're both playing off. And the people who are untrusting are often depicting a character not unlike the confidence man. And there are a couple of places where they revert to these nature imageries. There's one which says, like, well, would you hold the butterfly responsible for the caterpillar's sins? Mm-hmm. Right. And the other, which is a rattlesnake accountable? In a way, that's Trump's idea, right? I'm not consistent. I'm just doing. I'm a deal maker. I'm a guy who operates. I'm moving through this thing. And a lot of people are willing to make, as you said, these kind of disturbing excuses on his behalf.
Yeah. I mean, but even in a weird way, and this is true in this book, and one of the things I found resonant is that it doesn't really matter whether Trump does what he says he's going to do. It's the words themselves. So it's just putting out the idea, I'm going to give you health care. Everyone will be covered. It'll be cheaper. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. And in a way, it's just this empty promise. But what it makes people feel good. And there is an element in this book where his words are kind of sort of filling this void or making people happy or giving them love or giving them something they want to believe in. And whether he actually does it, and that's why I was like horrified to read this article in the Times today, whether he does it is sort of secondary. A lot of the people are saying, well, he's trying, but at least he said it. You know, at least he said he was going to repeal healthcare. I mean, and the thing is that what matters less is we kind of have this logical view that what matters is the follow through. What matters is if he can pass legislation or whether there's a wall. But in a strange way, it's the words that matter. It's the promises that matter. It's him at a speech saying things in the way he says things that matter, however they affect reality. I think that's the kind of scary thing I sort of saw connected here.
And I think that's what Philip Roth is talking about, right? I mean, because to be a con man would distinguish you among politicians. Because most politicians, they may lie, they may deceive people, but they don't think in their own minds that what they're doing is swindling people. They think they're helping people, and most of the time they manage to believe what they're saying. They make their beliefs accommodate reality. But the con man is distinguished, the confidence man is distinguished by knowing he is engaged in a conscious fraud. He's trying to get your watch away from you, and he's willing to do anything to accomplish his objective.
And words are just detached from reality. Like, give me your watch. You know, it's all detached. What he's offering you is just detached from anything real.
Words are strategies, yeah. Right? And you might use a totally different strategy with a different customer tomorrow. Because the object is to just get the watch, right? And if you have to beg them to trust you, that's fine. And you have to convince them that you're a cripple, that's fine. And to convince them you have the cure for world hunger, that's fine. Whatever you do have to do.
But also you have to sort of believe what you're saying. And that's part of this kind of crazy swarm of words that comes out of this guy as he starts to like just swamp people with his arguments. You know, because what he's saying is, I want you to believe completely in this Seminole Indian fund for the Seminole orphans and so forth. But in fact, he's stealing from them. So he's conjuring this thing that is really appealing to their better nature while he's working his worst. And you never know whether he's a person who believes that he's a crook or whether he believes that everybody's like this. This is just the way of the world, and everybody's doing it to everybody all the time, and there is no reality except the reality that just took place like 2 seconds ago because of your own invention. That's really unclear about this character. Well, Melville gives us that extra layer of showing us who the man behind the curtain is or isn't.
Yeah, it's true. I actually have a real-life con man in my life right now. So I was just thinking about this experience. And one thing about my con man is, like, if I'm emailing him or I'm talking to him on the phone, you come away from the email or the call feeling really good. Like, he'll always, like, give you what you want, even while he is, like, taking your money, like telling you, like, crazy lies, like, whatever he's doing. And he is doing those things. You're still feeling like great about yourself, about him. Yes, because he knows what to say to make you. And this con man does the same thing where you feel. And I mean, again, I'm feeling like, am I like a person at a Trump rally? You know, like you're feeling that something he's saying is giving you what you want. So when he's saying like, you know, I'll give you my friendship. There's a lot about friendship here and love and trust and, you know, all of this. He's kind of giving you a view of the world that you are very seduced by, even as you may even know. And that's one of the remarkable things. A lot of these people sort of know they're being conned or like are kind of aware of it for at least most of the time. But he's still, you know, they're like besotted with him. And I think that's an interesting element of this.
Tell us more about this con man in your life. Why do you have a con man in your life?
It is a really long story. I like can't extricate the con man from my life, but he knows, like I get this feeling that people come out of their interactions with him and they feel like when they've given him money or even they've lent him something or they've helped him out of this hard situation, he knows how to do it in such a way that he is giving them a vision of themselves that is positive, which is, I think, part of the essence here. And I think, again, people have talked about Trump and how he's kind of saying to some people who feel like they've been forgotten or not looked at or people look down on them, and he's kind of just giving them an image of themselves that they want, even as he's saying, like Philip was saying, like, everything's terrible, America's, you know, terrible.
But we're going to make it great again.
Right,
it's
and
like
we're
this will to believe.
And he is sort of saying, and you, the unemployed steelworker, are great. Like, he's still, communicating some sort of flattering vision.
Yes. I mean, and there's very much the sort of, the way that a con man makes you feel good is that he has some way to appeal to what it is that you'd like to believe. Mm-hmm. There, and he'll read that in different types. It's not all that different one from the other. As you say, there are only like a half dozen scams that are just replayed and replayed and replayed in all of world history. But there's a kind of alertness to the very specificity of the person that you're appealing to, and the willingness to say completely contradictory things, to say things that don't add up, and to always be sort of selling some kind of wonderful, implausible improvement is all part of it with him. You know, like what could be greater than a world in which everybody's trustworthy? That's what he's trying to sell.
Yeah. Well, I mean, being conned is a kind of deep experience. You know, I mean, I just was thinking while you were talking, I remember when I was in high school or college being conned by someone in the park, right? I think I was walking in Lincoln Park in Chicago, and there was a somewhat raggedy looking guy with a gas can, and he stopped me. I was young. And he said, I ran out of gas. I'm trying to get back to Florida. My family, sick relative, the whole thing. Like, good performance. I thought it was probably true. Like, I talked to him long enough, he believed. And I gave him $10, I think, for gas. And he wrote down my address. And he said, as soon as I get back to Florida, I'm going to send you the $10 back. I didn't really think I'd see it again, but I was happy to help him. And, I felt generous. I'd help this guy. And 2 days later, I was jogging in the park. Same guy, same gas can, walking through the park. And I just, it was a profoundly disillusioning experience, because what it taught me is don't be generous, don't trust people, assume that people are trying to trick you instead of assuming that most people are probably basically trustworthy most of the time.
It's weirdly emotional, because like that, it does exist on a weirdly, it's not all kind of convincing someone in a rational way. This is not about my own personal con man, but my husband recently had a con man who tried to buy a desk on Craigslist, and it turned into this really complicated thing where he was like needing my husband to give him extra money, and then he would send him a check, and it was really complicated. But at one point, he sent a text message and he said, "Your desk is my life." And at that point, I was like, my husband was like really into it. Like, he didn't really realize this was a con, like, till way after that. And I was like, when he said, "Your desk is my life," weren't you kind of like, "My desk is not your life"? But you get in, you kind of get sucked into the, you know, just slowly, little bit by bit, into this weird story. And then later you can be like, why did that happen? And that actually happens in this book quite a lot.
Well, one of the things apparently I remember reading about up on the Nigerian scam emails, the ones that just seem so preposterous, and they're often slightly ungrammatical, and they're sort of saying, you know, "I am the last prince of the such and such kingdom and have sole access to, you know, the gold reserves of such and such."
Imagine the real son of the Nigerian oil minister. Right. No one would ever respond to his emails.
So. Right. But so, but part of the ludicrousness of these letters is deliberate, because they want to get the rest of us early on, like, "Ha ha, no way." And they want to find that 1 in 1,000 or 5,000 people, because they're just blasting these things out into space, who's going to look at that and somewhere it's going to hit a register. It's going to make them think like, "Oh, is that an opportunity?" Or, "Oh, the poor man." And all the kind of bizarre questions like, "How on earth did he get my email here, like in St. Cloud, Minnesota, or wherever it is that this lady with her little pension is sitting and about to get robbed?" But it's more the will to believe, the sort of credulity, the implausibility somehow works as a credibility thing rather than for the rest of us. It obviously disqualifies it. And there's something about this guy in this book that's very, I think, ingeniously, even if it's often impenetrably Baroque language, he's ingeniously always sort of inviting your suspicion and saying, "You see, isn't that the insidious thing? Isn't your suspicion the thing that really stands between you and the world? Isn't that a sad and terrible thing that you should look at me and immediately feel suspicion? I just saw that glimmer of doubt in you. Let's override that doubt together." Yeah. Right? So it's like he's actually conning the con out of the con, you know, it's sort of like this triple layered approach that's pretty spectacular the way it works. And I think that's really what Melville's fascinated with here.
I mean, you've got this biography of Melville in front of you, so you can probably explain this, but I assume that he's there's something going on here with the interplay of religious faith and religious skepticism. And I don't know how much of a believer or skeptic Melville really was, but you could substitute for the petty scams, the stock frauds and patent medicines of the con man, the question of whether you have religious belief or doubt.
Yeah, I mean, he was not a believer, but he was fascinated by conjuring with questions of belief. He was in a really dark phase. So this was the last novel published in his lifetime, and it had this totally downward trajectory over time. You know, each book sold worse than the last.
And he wrote Moby Dick, which is a masterpiece of all time, and like nobody noticed it. Like it didn't sell. It got like the only person who appreciated him was Hawthorne, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And then he wrote this book, and he turns it in. He goes out and gets drunk with the publisher. There's actually a great story that Andrew Del Banco tells about that, which is pretty entertaining.
That's the biography.
Biography I have here, and he basically he goes out and he gets drunk with his publisher, and he was reported to have said, you know, he at some point told that great story from the Decameron of the enchantment of the husband and the tree. And Del Banco summarizes, "This was Boccaccio's tale about a young wife who persuades her much older husband that the pear tree in their garden has the power to make jealous forebodings seem real. Having convinced him that he should test the truth of what she says by climbing the magical tree, she has eager intercourse with a servant before her husband's eyes, humping away as if in a perfect seclusion, while the husband blames his jealousy rather than his wife." And apparently, the report on this dinner was it was just like one story after another in an orgy of indecency and blasphemy that he just went on like this. And so he was really in this dark place about humankind, right? Like everything was deceit and decline. And his family, he was also in debt, and his family decided like they should really get him out of there for a little while. And so they sent him off on this sort of trip to Europe and actually to the Middle East, where he just got more depressed. But along the way, he stops and he visits Hawthorne, who was like the consul for the United States. He'd got himself a diplomatic post in Liverpool. And there's just this wonderful, wonderful famous letter that Hawthorne wrote right afterwards about this visit that they had, and that they went and they walked among the dunes. And he said, "We sat down among the sandhills and smoked a cigar. Melville, as he always does, began to reason of providence and futurity and of everything that lies beyond human ken, and informed me that he had, quote, pretty much made up his mind to be annihilated. But still he does not rest in that anticipation, and I think will never rest until he gets hold of a definite belief. It is strange how he persists, and has persisted ever since I knew him and probably long before, in wandering to and fro over these deserts, as dismal and monotonous as the sand hills in which we were sitting. He can neither believe nor be comfortable in his unbelief, and he is too honest and courageous not to try to do one or the other. If he were a religious man, he would be one of the most truly religious and reverential. He has a very high and noble nature and better worth immortality than the rest of us. But, I mean, that's this tension between the attraction of belief and the attraction of sort of a divine plan and just insurmountable skepticism that defines a lot of his views here, and this darkness that haunts him, that haunts Ahab, that is part of this guy, the Indian hater in this book.
Yeah.
Is in some ways the most original character in it about American literature, and goes back to that kind of primordial Ahab, you know, revenge. Something wounded me.
This is a nested, just explain, it's a nested story in the book, where who tells the story? Is it the confidence
some judge?
It's like a judge.
It's one of the things that just comes up, and then you're in several pages in this story of this man, this early American settler, whose whole family has been wiped out by Indians, and then basically spends the rest of his life killing as many Indians as possible.
He's a colonel.
Yeah.
But it starts in the chapter before it, and it gets into the whole question of the paramount Indian hater and like the casual Indian hater. This chapter is called Containing the Metaphysics of Indian Hating According to the Views of One Evidently Not So Prepossessed as Rousseau in Favor of Savages. So, you know, which is also a theme in Moby Dick, right, where he talks about Queequeg, the cannibal harpooner whom he loves, as like, you know, what is Queequeg but George Washington cannibalistically developed? I mean, he's always breaking down these categories and pushing towards the idea that, in fact, we're universal. But this Indian hatred as sort of the fundamental kind of distrust, race hatred.
I was thinking about how, like, why is this book so, like, awful to read? Like, why is it?
And it
like,
really was.
It's
it
just
was
kind
so
of a
hard.
Horrible experience. But I think some of it has to do with the fact that words are like disconnected from their meanings in a weird way. Like, people are just saying all these things that are like irrational and come to nothing and inconsistent, like Philip was pointing out, and they're sort of like floating around. So it kind of makes you seasick almost. But then I also think it's like these stories that have like a moral, but it's like a fake moral, you know, or it's not or it's like nonsense.
Or you can't tell what the
moral is. Or you can't tell what the moral is, but there's like, they're sort of structured, so there is going to be a moral. So you're really confused because your mind is like searching for that like organizing principle or moral, or, and he's going to refuse it all the time. So that letter you read, the Hawthorne letter, kind of explained that a little bit, like the sad desert of that he's like in this sad desert. And I think that maybe why this book is so hard to read is like the sad desert is too much.
Yeah.
And detaching words from their meaning to this extent, you know, to sort of have this rhetoric that goes on and on and on, and it's kind of weirdly beautiful, but it like means nothing, is disturbing on some like really profound level.
I think you've sort of nailed it. I mean, the sort of the experience of the book is no trust. Right.
Yeah.
Because first of all, it's very hard to get any purchase on it. And then once you get purchase on it, you're usually in one of these side stories, but it's not, and you're sort of engaged in it, but you're completely dislocated by the nesting of the moral and whoever is telling the story. And you can't latch on to anything and support it anywhere in the book.
Yeah, it lacks all the things that sort of ground you in reading a book. It lacks a coherent plot. It lacks development between these stories. I mean, you sort of get the idea, but none of them really leads to the next.
Yeah.
I mean, you could read it a little
character.
Bit like a Rolodex, you know, in a spinning way. You could, or a carousel, you know, you could open it anywhere and go anywhere. I find that I underline a lot of great one-liners, but like can never remember the paragraph, much less the chapter they're in when I look back at them. You know, it's like there's no story. He doesn't really have a character because he's playing 10 different characters
roles.
And all of them are fictions. So it is, I mean, apparently this book in the 60s and 70s was sort of dug up by the early metafictionists who were sort of getting excited about Boris and Bart and all these people who are putting things in boxes. The last thing I'll read from this Andrew Del Banco biography is this contemporary review that gets at how bad it is to read. It's from the London Illustrated Times, and it said, "We began the book at the beginning, and after reading 10 or 12 chapters, found that we had not yet obtained the slightest clue to the meaning, in case there should happen to be any. After reading the work forwards for 12 chapters and backwards for 5, we attacked it in the middle, gnawing at it like Rabelais' dog at the bone, in the hope of extracting something from it at last. As a last resource, we read the work from beginning to end, and the result was that we liked it even less than before."
That's funny.
Ouch.
But if you read this Mississippi riverboat as a metaphor for the country in that period, and as you said, this kind of frantic, you know, period with all these sort of crazy schemes and crazy characters and people getting rich overnight and terrible injustice and you know, a high degree of chaos, then the sort of Trump idea does kind of fit in, because who succeeds and who profits in that environment? The confidence man, this person who, you know, takes advantage of this disarray and gets what he wants in the middle of the disorder.
Right. Sells plots in New Jerusalem. One person before he buys, "Isn't this plot on water? Oh, no, everything's on solid land." Yeah. You know, I mean, it's wild.
But I also think it kind of captures the disorientation, I think, that we feel like reading the news. There was a piece in Slate about like how annoying it is to keep comparing like Trump's old Twitter to like what he says now, because he's a hypocrite. Of course his words mean nothing. Like, of course he's kind of the con man, this like. And I feel like there's a lot of the journalism we read is like people trying to make sense out of these proclamations that are never going to make sense. Like, there is no logic. And then the kind of acceptance, which you have to do with this book, you're like disoriented, and then you just have to accept that it's never going to make sense and it's never going to come together. And I think that's kind of this idea of like what the truth is and what words mean is a little closer in The Confidence Man to the way Trump is using words. And that is part of that queasy feeling is like recognizable to me.
There was actually a fascinating piece that I read in Slate before the election by somebody, I'm forgetting his name, who had written a book about quacks and snake oil salesmen and sort of the history of various kinds of hucksters and like false cancer cures and so forth, often quite elaborate medical schemes and scams. And of course, those are one of the elements in here, the herbalist. And the happy doctor. And he was saying how, and the basic premise of this piece was, most people who support Trump, even if he totally betrays them and fails them, will not blame him, because the nature of a quack is different than somebody who makes a very realistic promise in a certain structure. Mm-hmm. And that because they've so banked on your own buying in with your belief, you're going to need to protect yourself from the idea that you were a fool and a dupe, right? And that's part of the confidence man's game. And they're going to seed and sow the thing all along the way, with mixture of false science and this, that there are so many things that could have gone wrong and so many others to blame and so many other ways to shift the explanation of this that spares them in order to spare yourself. And it was a really interesting piece that, again, plays off many of these themes and how they apply to, in just a kind of broad cosmic way, why you would imagine that Philip Roth originally was saying, you know, read this unreadable book, because it's really...
aside from sadism.
It's really,
aside
from it's pure really sadism. More about our times than my incredibly readable book about our times.
Thank you, Philip Roth. You gave us one good one and one tough one. I mean, just to wind up here, this is a sort of book like both of you, I didn't much enjoy reading it, and it was very difficult to get through, although I'm glad I read it. I mean, I'm glad to have read it. It's really, the ideas here are very interesting. And I also feel, you know, if I went back, like you read it again, once you're kind of, you know what's not to expect, like a story or characters.
Looking forward to the report on the reread.
That's not going to happen. But, you know, I feel like the discussion, I've enjoyed the discussion a lot more than I enjoyed reading the book.
Totally.
Well, I guess with that, it's time to thank you both.
Thank you.
Philip Gurevich of The New Yorker, Katie Roife from NYU, author most recently of The Violet Hour. Thanks for coming back on the show.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
That's it for our second TrumpCast book club. And we've picked a third book. I think it's going to be easier than the last one. It's Strangers in Their Own Land by Arlie Russell Hochschild. Pick up a copy and read it along with us. And hey, let us know what you think about this book club. It's a bit of an experiment, and we'd love your feedback. You can leave a comment at facebook.com RealTrumpCast. And we're on Twitter, too, @RealTrumpCast. Jason DeLeon produced today's show. Steve Lickteig is the executive producer of Slate Podcast. June Thomas is managing producer of Slate Podcast. And Andy Bowers is Panoply's chief content officer. I'm Jacob Weisberg. We'll be back later this week with more TrumpCast.